advisement, and we proceed to the last case of the United States versus Marrero. Mr. Kapnick?
Good morning. I'm Brad Kapnick, counsel for the appellant in this case, Edwin Marrero. I'll be presenting the only argument for appellants this morning as they both raise the same interstate commerce issue in their joint brief. This case involves a simple robbery. That's admitted by all the participants to the crime. The only question here is whether the robbery had a sufficient effect on interstate commerce as required by a prosecution under the Hobbs Act. Now, the Peterson case only last year reaffirmed that the interstate commerce element must be the subject of proof in a Hobbs Act prosecution. The government only needs to show a de minimis effect on interstate commerce, but it can't be the subject of conjecture, guesswork, or strained inferences. In this case, the government had three theories, only one of which makes any sense on the facts of this case, but let me go through them briefly. The first theory was that the victims in this case were cocaine dealers. There's scant evidence in the record that they were even drug dealers. Mr. Hernandez's confession refers to them as three black males from Detroit. He doesn't refer to them as drug dealers.
But you're not saying that the government didn't introduce evidence from the offenders that the victims came to purchase cocaine, are you?
No. There is evidence that the victims came to purchase cocaine or that it was set up that they were
coming. And not for their own use, presumably.
There's no evidence on that.
But I mean, I don't think people would come from Detroit and Chicago just to buy for their own use.
Well, there's no evidence of that, Your
Honor. Can we use some common sense? Or is that forbidden?
No, it's not. Common sense is not forbidden. The only evidence in the record is that they were drug dealers. Jose Roman testified.
Okay, they were drug dealers. I thought you said they weren't drug dealers.
No, I said there's no evidence they were cocaine dealers. There's evidence in the record that Mr. Roman, the government.
Well, it doesn't matter what they are. What do you think they came to buy?
I think they were shopping for cocaine. I think that's what the evidence establishes. I think the evidence establishes.
Well, then they came to dealers, aren't they? I don't know what you're saying.
Well, I don't. They came to purchase a large amount of cocaine, 1 kilo of cocaine.
But they brought a lot of money with them, right?
They did bring $22,000. The amount that was mentioned concerning a possible sale or offer to sale was $25,000. So they didn't even have enough money to complete the cocaine transaction.
Well, maybe they haggled.
Pardon, Your Honor?
Maybe they would have haggled.
Maybe they would have. There's absolutely no evidence in the record concerning that.
You're saying no evidence. So cocaine dealers with $22,000 come across state lines to Chicago to buy this stuff, and they're robbed, so now they don't have their $22,000. So presumably they don't buy any cocaine. They go back empty-handed. And there's less to sell in Detroit.
Well, let me break that down, Your Honor. First, coming across state lines, the only evidence in the record is that they were from Detroit.
Oh, you think they're just talking about where they're born?
Yeah.
These are people from Detroit.
Your Honor, you can say that Michael Jordan comes from North Carolina, but he hasn't lived there in 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, that's okay. Let's move
and all the cases
there.
They rely on.
Yeah, but that's silly. So what's your next argument?
The only theory that makes any sense in our view of the case is their theory that relies on Your Honor's opinion in Thomas, that the interstate transaction that was interfered with in this case was a potential cocaine transaction, the one that you're referring to. But this case is very different from Thomas. In Thomas, the undercover agent was poised to purchase cocaine. He had the money.
No, I don't think that's the proper analogy here. These people have the $22,000. They came to buy the drugs, and they came to do something with $22,000. And as a result of this being lured to this spot, this phony sale, they lose their $22,000, so they go back to Detroit empty-handed. And if it hadn't been for this crime, they probably would have bought drugs and gone back and sold it. So it interrupted this interstate drug business these victims were running.
With all due respect, Your Honor, we don't believe the evidence shows that. We believe that what's presented in this case is the issue that Your Honor identified but left open in the Thomas case, namely, when does the robbery of personal items of limited amount affect interstate commerce?
Look, these people have $22,000. They want to buy drugs, which is an international market, and they're going to Chicago to buy drugs, going somewhere to buy drugs. So I don't understand why this commerce wasn't interrupted by the fact that their money was taken away from them.
Well, the commerce wasn't interrupted because when they came to the house on Haddon Street, they weren't poised to make a drug transaction. They were inspecting the cocaine.
What would they have done with that $22,000? Why were they they were carrying $22,000 to buy drugs. That's what they wanted to do.
Well, there's no evidence of that.
You keep saying no evidence, but I don't understand you. Why would they come with $22,000 to Chicago?
$22,000 is not a lot of money in
what,
the grand economy.
What, to carry on your person to go from Detroit to Chicago with $22,000 in your pocket? What are they going to
do? It's only 30% of the jurisdictional minimum in a diversity case.
What an inconsequent comment that is. What does that have to do with anything?
Well, Your Honor, there are people who carry large amounts of money around, and there's no evidence at all that in this case,
you keep saying no evidence at all because you break up the case into little tiny pieces and you imagine alternative possibilities for each little piece, but you don't look at it as a whole with some, you know, modicum of common sense. The disruption of the drug traffic may have been very small, but the notion that they didn't come to buy drugs is ridiculous. They came to have a spree at the McCormick place or something.
Let me move on.
Rush Street with $22,000.
Let me move on to the other argument, Your Honor, the sentencing issue. We submit, Your Honor, that Mr. Marrero's sentence, which was enhanced as a criminal offender based on two prior convictions, both prior convictions involved offenses where there was joint planning involved, as required by this court in Joy and Ali. In the first offense, Mr. Marrero sold cocaine to an undercover agent, 7.8 grams of cocaine. During the commission of that offense, the undercover officer told Mr. Marrero that if the powder is good, I'll be back. Then a little over two months later, Mr. Marrero, or the undercover agent, goes back to Mr. Marrero again and purchases cocaine in a larger amount. We submit that based on the only Court of Appeals case on point, the Robinson case from the Fifth Circuit, on virtually identical facts, although there's a slight difference, an irrelevant difference in the facts, that this was joint planning. In the Robinson case, purported to apply this court's precedent, and we believe that the same result ought to obtain here. Thank you. Unless there's any questions, I'll have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Skip.
Thank you.
Mr. Scar?
Please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Richard. I represent the United States. Now, reviewing the facts in the light most favorable to the government, there was sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude in this case that the defendant's robbery affected interstate commerce. The fact of the instant case indeed falls squarely within United States versus Thomas and United States versus Bailey, both cases where the robbery of money that was intended to purchase cocaine was found to affect interstate commerce. Here, the facts were easily sufficient for the jury to conclude that three drugs.
It's a peculiar case because how do we know what, if there hadn't been this crime, how do we know what these people would have done with their $22,000?
I'm not sure we can predict what they would have done. I think given the fact that we have, they were drug dealers who had come to Chicago from Detroit to purchase cocaine. They had not been robbed by the defendants, who did not have the cocaine to sell to them. Perhaps they would have gone elsewhere.
Why had they come to Chicago?
According to Juan Hernandez's co-conspirator statement that was offered, he indicated that they'd come to Chicago to purchase a kilogram of cocaine for $25,000.
From these people.
Exactly.
So they were lured here.
Exactly.
So, suppose there hadn't been the lure, then they wouldn't have left Detroit. How do we know what they would have done with the $22,000?
Judge, I think we can reasonably infer, based on the facts, that they had that money to purchase a kilogram of cocaine. They weren't lured to Chicago to purchase it. They might have purchased it in Detroit. They might have purchased it in Indiana. They might have purchased it in any number of places.
Aren't there statistics that show that cocaine is a better deal in Chicago than it is in Detroit?
Judge, I believe that the DEA expert who testified indicated that Chicago is a trying to find the word that he used because he was an expert.
Source city?
It is a source city. It's a hub city. So cocaine in large quantities comes to Chicago. At that point, then distributed to certain other cities in the Chicagoland area, including Milwaukee, Detroit, and likely places in Indiana. Obviously, the further it goes along, the greater the cost to actually purchase it. So coming to Chicago, presumably, would provide a cheaper cost of cocaine than waiting for it to arrive in Detroit, adding to that the cost of actually having to move the risk and the cost of having to move it from Chicago to a end city like Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, as Your Honors have noted, not only were they robbed of the money to purchase cocaine, they were lured across state lines to be robbed.
Suppose they had their $22,000 and they're about to buy cocaine in Detroit. And all of a sudden, these thieves call up and say, look, come to Chicago and we'll give you twice as much for your $22,000. So they go to Chicago and they're robbed. So in that case, what would have been disrupted would have been an intrastate sale in Detroit.
An intrastate sale in Detroit,
right.
Correct. However,
that would take away one of your theories of interstate obstruction.
It would take away the theory that they directly crossed state lines. However, under Thomas and Bailey, which were intrastate cases, the fact of the matter is they were robbed of money intended to purchase cocaine. Obviously, the second prong of that is cocaine is a good that necessarily moves in interstate commerce.
But doesn't this mean that every robbery can be prosecuted under the Hobbs Act?
I think there's a distinction, particularly when it comes to cocaine dealing, which is what's issued here, and actually that's cited.
Well, forget cocaine dealing, just ordinary robberies.
No.
Rob a bottle of aspirin from a local drugstore. That comes from another state.
It's a loaded question, and Judge, there's no way clearly that it's simply a robbery of aspirin in and of itself.
What's the difference?
The difference is that we're dealing with a good that by definition must move interstate.
What do you mean by definition? It just moves interstate because it doesn't happen to be grown here.
Can't be grown here.
What do you mean can't be grown here?
Cannot be grown here.
Of course it could be grown here.
It cannot be grown here.
You couldn't grow it in a greenhouse?
You cannot expect that. That was the evidence that was offered in the district court. There are three requirements in order to grow cocaine, which is why it grows in South America. Altitude.
No, altitude just means how much oxygen is in the air.
According
you can surely simulate conditions in the Andes in a laboratory in Chicago.
According to the DEA expert, it's never happened, which is what we're relying on, Joe.
For all I know, aspirin has never been manufactured in Chicago. So what? You really think that what the Hobbs Act turns on is these kind of agricultural insights that you're offering us?
I'm quite sure when it was passed, it was
ridiculous.
Not based on agricultural insights, Your Honor, but the evidence that we provided.
Well, what if you stole a bamboo shoot from a Chinese restaurant in Chicago? Bamboo shoots don't grow in Illinois either.
Well, I think if the also drawing on Bailey, if the overall effect the theft of those monies would have a significant, or bamboo shoots would have a significant effect on
commerce. Okay, so we're back to the proposition that any theft any theft violates the Hobbs Act. What is your example of a theft that doesn't violate the Hobbs Act?
Well, in Peterson, the theft of marijuana didn't violate the Hobbs Act, because the evidence indicated that marijuana can be cultivated in Indiana.
If the victims were from Illinois rather than Detroit, would you argue that there's still enough to support the Hobbs Act solely because the transaction was to involve cocaine?
Yes, Judge. I believe that position is exactly what occurred in Thomas, and also exactly what occurred in Bailey, which in both cases, in fact, there was money stolen, not even from actual drug dealers, but from government agents that was going to be used to purchase cocaine. And both of those courts concluded that even though those were within the, I believe even in the Northern District of Illinois, cases, that that was sufficient.
In your marijuana case, say marijuana can grow in Illinois, but suppose a particular marijuana stolen was from another state. Does that violate the Hobbs Act?
Judge, I think if you could definitively prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that marijuana was a marijuana cultivated in another state, I think there would be an argument that it did violate the Hobbs Act.
Well, then it's just like the bottle of acid.
Mm-hmm.
So you're now arguing that any time something that across state lines is stolen, you have a Hobbs Act violation.
I think if you robbed a interstate shipment of goods, you would have a Hobbs Act violation. If there was evidence that indicated those goods were solely manufactured intrastate, you'd have a problem from the government's perspective in terms of charging that as a Hobbs Act violation.
So if you walk into a drugstore and you say, if you go into a drugstore and you steal money from the cash register, you deplete the drugstore's ability to buy goods from out of state. It's just like this case, isn't it?
I think that's right. I think that if you...
But then any theft from a business is a Hobbs Act.
From a business that purchases goods interstate, that would be the government's position.
So you want the state's attorneys to have nothing to do?
Oh, they
But you said, in answer to my first question, that the theft of the bottle of aspirin wasn't a Hobbs Act violation. Now you've turned all the way around.
I think perhaps I have. If, in fact, the theft of the aspirin was one where the aspirin could be proven to have been manufactured out of state, it would be the government's position that there's a depletion of an interstate good.
There's no de minimis concept here?
Well, actually, I believe in Thomas, the de minimis concept was considered and rejected because the aggravate...
Right, the class of offense.
Right.
So you really have no limiting principles for the Hobbs Act, even though the Supreme Court obviously is troubled with the relentless expansion of the concept of interstate commerce.
Well, the Supreme Court has clearly said it need only have a very de minimis effect, and that, in fact, because there are attempts, not even an actual effect. I think the expansion should be...
And, of course, the paradox here is that actually the government wants to disrupt the cocaine trade. If when it happens, you say, they're restricting interstate commerce.
That's exactly right. There is a paradox, Judge. As for Mr. Marrero's career offender status, it's the government's position that the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding that his two prior drug dealing convictions were, in fact, not part of the same scheme or plan. Thank you for
your
time.
Thank you, sir. Stephanie. I just have a few brief comments. I'd like to focus on the question raised by Judge Posner, whether any robbery violates the Hobbs Act. And I think that's the crux of what this case is about. It's the issue that was left open in Your Honor's opinion in Thomas. There are the 5th, 6th, 8th, 9th, and 11th Court of Appeals have all held that the robbery
of personal items in small amount does not necessarily violate interstate commerce. There's a number of cases decided under that standard, and we submit that that those cases require a reversal of the conviction here as well.
Were the amounts at all?
In one case, in Collins, it was the theft or the robbery of a Mercedes automobile. In many of the other cases, it was fairly small amounts. The theft of 4,000.
But they're thefts from individuals, aren't they?
Yes, they're all thefts.
Well, that makes a difference.
Well, Your Honor, we don't believe that there was any interstate business proven here. Even if the $22,000, Your Honor posited several questions about whether the $22,000 were used to come to Chicago to buy drugs. But if you assume that interstate travel was not proved here, there's no evidence at all that the $22,000 came from a cocaine business. You may infer from the size of the purchase, the kilogram of cocaine that was going to be purchased, it's possible to infer that that cocaine was going to be sold. But there's no inference at all. It has to be an inference on an inference to assume that they were selling cocaine somewhere else. I see my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Kapnick, I'd like to extend a special thanks to the court for your accepting this appointment.
Thank you very much.
The court will stand in recess.